With extraordinary events come extraordinary opportunities. In my work as a college dean, I have seen my industry, higher education, react to the COVID pandemic with an array of actions that have ranged from the innovative and successful to the catastrophic. Some colleges have begun to redefine themselves and are growing. Others have not been able to ride the tide of change and have closed, merged, or been broken into parts for salvage. The success of those reactions has been defined by courage, optimism, and openness. At Goddard College, where I work, our Washington State programs were the first to be impacted by the pandemic, as that state took early and broad actions last year. Gatherings were severely limited, and that meant that we either had to find money to create medical safety protocols or move everything online. In March of last year, we moved wholly online. It was tough on everyone. Students railed against the loss of community. Faculty wailed about the difficulty of performing in Zoom. Staff flailed about putting together a workable system to support dozens of Zoom rooms with access through online schedules and on and on, teaching faculty and students how to sign in, moderate, record their sessions, etc. It was chaos. It was creative, and we didn't have time to think about what could go wrong. We just had to get it done. It was not pretty, but it worked well enough. Good enough became a mantra. In the year and a half since then, we have begun to plan for partial re-entry to on-site programming, creating a combination of in-person options and online options. This combination has been referred to as a hybrid model. We were lucky. At Goddard, we have been hybrid for 20 years. Our first week of the semester is done in person, and then all the students and faculty go home to complete their term from a distance. That has allowed us to prepare for a more radical version of hybrid, one where students, faculty, and staff can choose in person or online on a day-by-day basis. This model is called HyFlex. It also allows a greater flexibility for people who are trying to find new ways of teaching and learning while other aspects of their lives are also changing. As most other colleges have played out their version of this transformation, choosing when and how to bring people back to campuses and what to put online, students have become increasingly used to having new options and new perspectives on what works for them as learners. In a sense, the online genie is out of the bottle for college students in a way no one was preparing for. The bottle, students are not interested in doing things the old ways. College will never be the same. And you know what? The sky fell, and it wasn't the end of the world. We didn't want it, we hadn't planned on it, but we're making the best of it. Another aspect of these experiences has been about relationships and the community of learning. Some students and faculty have been traumatized by the lack of in-person connections. They have been disoriented, depressed, anxious, and grieving. Yet most have gone on to adapt effectively. As I have thought back over the past 18 months and my work, I have seen some encouraging reactions, some inspiring courage, and some unexpectedly wonderful changes. Assessing these needs, reactions, and outcomes has reminded me of some important psychological functions involved in adapting to the success we have had in surviving as a college and how they relate to larger issues in our lives. I want to share some of those lessons and the psychology behind them for your own use as we enter what is being called the new normal. But first, I want to remind you that we have been this way before. With extraordinary events come extraordinary opportunities. After the first two major waves of the last pandemic, the waves of infections in 1918 and again in 1920, with the end of the World War I, the U.S. economy began a boom. But the economy was not the only part of society that was reemerging and reimagining. Social norms began to change, in part fueled by our soldiers' experiences of life in Europe, and the horrors of that particularly brutal war, but also fueled by changes that happened at home, changes we would see again, even more amplified, during World War II. Women took part in the workforce in new and empowering ways. Women began to vote. Sex was back on the social and cultural menu in a variety of ways, from improved and more accessible contraception to representations in the arts. Blues, jazz, and all sorts of other liberating and personalized expressions and movements came out of the closet. Popular musical hits like Ma Rainey's C.C. Rider from 1924, Cole Porter's songs Let's Mivs Behave from 1927 and Let's Do It from 1928 were clear reflections of the changes already in place and ready for discussion. Maestro? Anything Goes, from Cole Porter, 1934. Now, like then, the world and each of us is coming out of isolation and separation into a new world, a new economy, and an unknown future of changing values and behaviors. We see similar reactions across the political spectrum. Liberation movements, the exclamations and explorations of new voices, the claiming of power by the disenfranchised, confusion and uncertainty in the middle, and conservative backlash. We see the rise of fascism and the liberal backlash. I would draw a line from the anarchists of the last century to the QAnons of today. Again, the young rail against the limits of the world their parents have left them. Economy, ecology, jobs, home ownership, birth rates, and the value of marriage are themes for the young. We hear the wailing of the dominant generations about what is being lost. We see the flailing of governments, corporations, and communities to adjust and lead through dust that has not yet settled. We emerge from chaos unbound. Welcome to our roaring 20s. With extraordinary events come extraordinary opportunities. Let's talk about happiness. So why happiness? My purpose is to invite you to face the new normal with courage, optimism, and openness, to practice being happy with what evolves, and to shape your new normal. To those ends, I'm going to share some psychological information. I'm going to ask you to do a couple of thought experiments. And I'll ask you to give yourself some time later to think and to act. Psychological research tells us that personality influences our ability to affect happiness. For most of us, about half our ability to alter our view of ourselves, the way we see the world, and our attitudes about how we are in the world are changeable. About half is not changeable because of our genetics and those life circumstances we cannot change. But if you're thinking that your life circumstances give you an out, that those circumstances preclude you from being able to change, that's likely your attitude talking and probably not the genetic part, and probably not your circumstance of life. Life circumstances account for only about 10% of the portions of our worldview and our view of ourselves that are not changeable. You can probably think of somebody with severely worse circumstances than your own who is happy anyway. If you can't think of one such example, then that's the first thing I'm going to ask you to do during coffee hour. Ask somebody to borrow their example. The pandemic has changed our world, but it's not the only trouble we've had to face. We have all been affected. We have lost friends and loved ones. We have all been isolated and sequestered, living under the threat of death and illness. We have witnessed horrors of disease and violence across the land. In our first thought experiment, I'm going to ask you to please take a moment to think of those months of isolation before the vaccines, before things began to return to normal. And please identify a loss you experienced or an image of something you found upsetting. Then in your heart, name something good that came from that. Perhaps a fond memory of someone separated or lost. Perhaps the ways that people came together in response to that image, or whatever it is that you can see that balances the loss with a blessing. If you'd like, please close your eyes and take a moment to revel in that blessing. Now, that wasn't very long, but for some of you, it may have been too long. I'll ask each of you, if you choose to practice these thought experiments later, to give yourself more time than we're giving now, up to several minutes, if you like. We have lived through these things, but they are not over. We have vaccines for a virus, but no inoculation against fear and uncertainty. In the face of uncertainty, we have choices. To make use of these extraordinary choices, we must understand where our power comes from. We must own our right to choose. To a great extent, happiness, contentment, and a willingness to face new things positively are choices. Now, I don't mean to say that clinical depression, anxiety, and the like are choices. They are not. Those very real illnesses need professional attention, and they are treatable. If you think you or somebody you may know may need such help, please seek it. If you need to, ask for help to seek it. There is help all around us if we but ask. I want us to focus on the practices and attitudes that we can control to help us face what comes next, whatever that new normal becomes for each of us. What do we do with that half of ourselves that we can change to be more confident and happy? First, let's look at what doesn't work. Wanting things generally doesn't work. Wanting things creates a treadmill effect. You get what you want, and you want another, or more, or a different thing that leads to another thing, and around you go. Research tells us that part of this is because we think that if we don't get that thing, the thing of the moment, then we'll be unhappy. Wanting things, clothes, house, booze, chocolate, sex, whatever, sets us up to fear not getting them again. But the fact is that our brains aren't very good at that kind of prediction. Most people, when they stop and think about how disappointed they'd be if they don't get that thing, whatever it is, they imagine sorrow way out of proportion with the irritation they experience if they don't actually get it. The fear is not realistic. The anticipated disappointment is exaggerated. This is because these things are usually circumstantial. They are fleeting in their importance in our lives. Happiness tends to come from the behaviors we practice, not the things around us. Now, the Buddhist among us will point out, rightly, that it's not the things but the wanting that leads to unhappiness. I agree. However, there are many things in our brains that our brains are wired to do, and wanting is one of the most basic. Now, if you have the time and inclination to work on that deep level to reduce your wanting, I support you. If you don't, or are otherwise interested in a middle way, then changing some less fundamental behaviors may provide some satisfactory results. The behaviors most clearly associated with happiness are not going to be surprising to you. In our hearts, we all know these things, but researchers would be out of work and psychologists would be stuffed in museums if we all successfully retrained ourselves to be well and happy on our own. Here's what works. Questioning our desires. Taking time when we recognize we are wanting something to interrogate the source and the purpose of that desire. This requires us to challenge our initial reactions and our assumptions. This is a tough one, but it's important. Again, our brains don't do this easily. Research shows that when we anticipate the disappointment we would feel if we don't get that object of desire, on a scale of 1 to 10, we expect that the difference between the satisfaction of getting it and the despair of failure will be a few to several of those points. So I'm thinking, getting it would put my happiness at an 8 or a 9, not getting it would drop me to a 5 or lower. Who wants to go through that? The fact is that over and over, people, upon reflection of life events and in controlled conditions, demonstrate a drop of less than one of those points on the scale of 1 to 10. I really thought that new job would change my life, but you know what? Not getting it really didn't mean that much to me after all. People who are happy interrogate their desires. Savoring. Take a moment to revel in an experience that has meaning for us. The simple act of stopping our march to the next thing, focusing on something, ideally in the moment that it happens, to savor the feelings, reinforces our ability to experience gratitude. People who are happy practice savoring. Doing good for others. Call it practicing random acts of kindness, or doing good in the world, or paying it forward. But giving of ourselves to others supports our ability to see ourselves as agents in the world. We can change things. We can make things better. This combats a sense of being stuck in our muck. People who are happy to do things for others. Second thought experiment. Take a moment and think of a time, hopefully recently, that you did something kind for someone else, something altruistic. What did you feel? Please close your eyes for a moment and savor that feeling, not the thoughts that went with it, just the feelings that came with doing something kind for someone else. Thank you for trying that experiment. Here are a couple of more things that work. Doing meaningful things. We constantly choose to do one thing and not others. Those choices are more often than we suppose within our power to change. As we improve our awareness of our choices, we can choose the meaning we make of the world and the values we hold dear to make more meaningful choices. This can be little things. I'm shopping for coffee, I value sustainability, and support small farms. So I choose the fair trade, small batch coffee instead of the store brand. Happy people work their values into their choices. Socialize. Whether in person, online, through text, or letters, recent research shows that the methods don't matter as much as we thought. Community can be built online. Happy people are connected to other people. Practice gratitude. Beyond the savoring I mentioned a moment ago, finding ways of sharing your experience of gratitude in a diary, with a note of thanks, with a kind word or a heartfelt story, reminds us that we are worthy of good experiences and that the world can be a great place to be. People who are happy use gratitude to feel optimism. Practice optimism. When we choose how we will react to something, I know that it can seem like reactions just come up and take control, but we do have a choice. And when we make a conscious decision to frame things in a positive perspective, then we make the world a better place. People who are happy work to see the bright side. Exercise. Enough said. Move that body. It shows you care. People who are happy do things that exercise their bodies. Now, there are a couple of themes that run through these behaviors I think are worth pointing out. Make time for practicing things that make you a happier person. Make meaning of things that put you and the world in a better place or in a better perspective. Exercise your agency to choose, to act, and make meaning. With extraordinary events come extraordinary opportunities. Your new normal is still emerging. Have a say in what it becomes. You will not get this kind of opportunity again. Assess your new normal. As new patterns emerge, question them. When there is pressure to get back to how things used to be, ask why. If you're feeling stuck, ask why. Tweak the new normal. Try a new thing you did not do or did differently before the pandemic. If you know you need to restart something that you had to give up for the pandemic, claim it in terms of your values. As I'm starting to do this again, why? And what does it mean to me? If you're not feeling stuck, figure out why. Defend your new normal. Changing the kinds of behaviors that we've been looking at can have an impact on others. Be ready to explore their reactions. Be ready to defend your right to change. Be ready to compromise if there are new ways others propose. Changing the kinds of behaviors I've been talking about can have an impact on how we see ourselves. Be real about your self-judgments. It's not selfish to ask for your book group to consider a different day to meet. Doing things differently can be confusing. Don't be thrown off by feeling odd when you're trying something new. Be patient with yourself and with others. You aren't the only one navigating a new normal. All of this offers you a reminder that you have agency. You get to make choices to make the most of these new opportunities. You have the right to make changes in yourself, in your desires, and in your relationships. Now let's review very quickly. People who are happy interrogate their desires. People who are happy practice savoring. People who are happy do things for others. Happy people work their values into their choices. Happy people are connected to other people. People who are happy use gratitude to feel optimism. People who are happy work to see the bright side. And happy people exercise their bodies. I believe one of the hallmarks of the new normal will be a greater expectation for flexibility in our lives, more ways of doing things we need or want to do. Technology will support that in a variety of ways, but it may bring with it an increased demand for people to become more technologically sophisticated. Flexibility isn't just about things and the technology of things. It's also about shifting norms for relationships, communications, commitments, and community. All of these will evolve at a pace faster than we expect. Get ready. And in the immortal words of Mr. Rogers, listening is where love begins, listening to ourselves and then our neighbors. It is an extraordinary time to be alive. I am grateful to share this time with you, and I am grateful for your attention. Be well, be purposeful, and for goodness sakes, be happy. Thank you. Thank you.